KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Ben Franklin had his kite, Schrodinger his cat, Galileo a cannonball. They're all part of physics folklore, but within each is a lesson about how the universe works. Jennifer Ouellette's new book relates those stories and a lot more. It's called Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, and it's an attempt to bring physics within reach of everyone who's afraid of math and scared of science. It's a book that places physics within the context of art, contemporary culture, and a bunch of fascinating characters. All about Einstein, Isaac Newton, Reddy Whip, and Velcro. Next on Form, after this. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Jennifer Ouellette is a former English major and self-confessed one-time physics phobe. But the history of physics is precisely what she tackles in her new book, Black Bodies and Quantum Cats. Each chapter begins with a reference most of us, physics phobes included, can easily get. Chapter 1, for example, starts out by talking about the popular novel The Da Vinci Code. The chapter on gravity begins with a reference to the quirky movie Addams Family Values. And the chapter on relativity with the story of Marty McFly and Back to the Future. Along the way, we learn about Einstein, but we also learn about Reddy Whip and Velcro and why deregulating the power industry actually defies good physics. Well, that wants us to understand physics not because it's something we should have learned in high school, but because it's so integral to understanding our world today. And not just the cold, hard world of scientific fact. Understanding physics, she argues, helps us understand art and culture and all of life. And so, as a self-confessed physics phobe and a one-time former English major, it's my particular pleasure to welcome Jennifer Ouellette to Forum. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us. I want to ask you first if there was a sort of turning point moment for you as someone who, as you describe yourself, was afraid of math and physics. Was there a turning point for you when suddenly you weren't phobic about it and instead you were fascinated?
Well, it started when I took a job with the American Physical Society, and there really was a defining moment because for a while there I was simply, you know, one of the staff members. There were physicists around, and I got to know them as people and talk to them about their research. But they were still a little bit intimidating. But then there was one particular day where I walked into the copy room at the offices, and there were literally three Nobel laureates in physics standing around the copy machine going, "Should we press start?" And to me, that was a very defining, humanizing moment, and it taught me something very, very important, which is that it wasn't that they couldn't grasp the copy machine. A physicist invented the copy machine. They could tell you all about the physics behind how it worked, but they were unfamiliar with the actual hands-on technology, and it taught me that unfamiliarity can sometimes induce an irrational fear of a subject. And that was a very instant epiphany moment for me where I realized that just my unfamiliarity with physics was the root of my fear, not the fact that it was scary and difficult inherently.
So is step one, in a sense, then, to become somewhat more comfortable with unfamiliarity and to be more comfortable with ambiguity?
I would say that, certainly. That's definitely been a defining thing in my life, is facing my own fears. And invariably what I find is that it stems from my unfamiliarity with something. And the minute that I confront that and make myself familiar with it, I can overcome that. And that was a lesson I learned from the physicists, and I'm very grateful to them for it.
You, one of the characters that you, and there are characters in your book, but one of them is Richard Feynman, who was a Nobel laureate and quite a personality in many ways. But you quote him as saying that not knowing is much more interesting than believing an answer that might be wrong. So that's some of it too, right? That you have to be just curious about what you don't know.
Right, exactly. And you have to be willing to embrace not knowing. That was Feynman's genius, to my mind. He was very, very comfortable with not having the answer. And the best physicists, I think, are very much like that, because physics is not about having all the answers. Physics is about the journey. It's about discovery. That's what the whole scientific method is about. It's about testing and retesting and never quite having the answer. And they love that about that. That's something I think that the average layperson doesn't grasp. They think that there's an absolute truth in physics. Mm-hmm. But even the theory of gravity, which has been proven to the umpteenth decimal point, and certainly I will put my faith in gravity. I will not be jumping off the roof anytime soon. But even then, there's always this slight chance somewhere down the line that some test that they do will not fall in line with general relativity. And that little tiny possibility that could revolutionize physics as we know it, that happens once every couple hundred years, that's what makes the field so exciting and always evolving.
Which also brings us to how physics and science are taught and in the way in which it can kind of encourage or incubate that sense of curiosity. You quote Einstein as saying, "It's almost a miracle that modern teaching methods have not yet entirely strangled the holy curiosity of inquiry. For what this delicate little plant needs more than anything besides stimulation is freedom."
Mm-hmm.
Talk about how important that part of this is. If we're to get over our fear, it also, I would sense, has something to do about the way in which that's encouraged, that sense of curiosity and within our schools.
Right, and I think to a certain extent that's missing. I don't want to, paintbrush all science teachers with a negative tar or anything like that, but obviously, when I was in high school, which was more years than I'd care to think about at this point, it was not well taught. You had a set curriculum. For me, when I was taking algebra and math and science and all these things, even though I was good at them, there were these vital connections that weren't being made. And even more, I think, than the freedom to pursue inquiries, it's the freedom to make these unusual connections, which is what I did in the book, making connections between science and art and pop culture. You need to do the same thing with math and physics and chemistry and biology. And you need to let people know that they are not isolated. They are not meant to be kept separate from each other. They're meant to feed into each other and strengthen each other. And then you can all go off and follow your inquiry and then come together and get that feedback again. That interdisciplinary nature, I think, is where the future of physics is.
Jennifer Ouellette is our guest this morning. She's the author of Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, Tales from the Annals of Physics. On that question of sort of the continuity between various forms of knowledge, you write about how Leonardo saw no distinction between art and science. And your first chapter is really about this idea of the so-called golden ratio or divine proportion, and the way in which you can find that term from physics in art, whether that's the Mona Lisa or the Venus de Milo or a Gregorian chant. Describe that for us, what that divine proportion is and how that ripples out in the world of art.
Right. Well, obviously, anyone who's read the Da Vinci Code has had at least a small familiarity with the golden ratio. It's basically a mathematical equation where you just measure the ratios of, say, the sides of a rectangle, and if it comes out to, say, 1.618 when you divide them into each other, they are said to be in divine proportion. What I find most fascinating about it, obviously, people like Leonardo da Vinci, who were familiar with the golden ratio, for them, it denoted a certain divine symmetry. Da Vinci wanted to work that into his art. Much of his art had a religious theme to it. So for him, it was a very natural thing to get this perfect symmetry. Vitruvian Man, that famous sketch of the male figure, the male form, definitely has about three or four different golden rectangles that it's built upon. What I find fascinating about it, when I was studying math, I was good at math, but I never really made the connection. I wish at the time that my teacher had talked about the divine proportion, because that's a way of saying, okay, math is not just this abstract realm. It actually ties into the real world. Mm-hmm. This corresponds to that. This number thing, this abstract number, actually translates into beauty, aesthetic beauty here on Earth, and something that we can appreciate.
And there's a connection definitely between math, of course, and music.
Yes, absolutely. I did study music when I was growing up. Again, it wasn't quite the same. I didn't quite make those connections, and I wish now that I had. But that whole notion that of the music of the spheres that was prevalent in the Renaissance and things like that, that definitely arose from the idea of mathematical octaves, constructs, patterns that we see all around us. And I think that there's definitely a human affinity for this. Certainly certain physicists that I interviewed for the book, among them Bülent Atalay, who wrote Math and the Mona Lisa, he specifically said that he believes that human beings have a natural affinity for the divine proportion, which is why it pops up in so much of our art and architecture.
And sometimes probably not necessarily by intent. I mean, it seems part of what you're suggesting is there is almost a natural draw, a natural affinity to that. It's not like Mozart set out to say, okay, I'm going to involve the divine proportion in this next concerto that I compose. But somehow that draws us in. Somehow we're comfortable or we're drawn to that sort of proportionality.
Yeah, actually, I think that is the case. Artistic intent, as I say in the book, is notoriously difficult to predict unless you can actually interview the author. It can be a little bit dangerous to read into it. I think we're on pretty safe ground with Da Vinci because he actually co-authored a book called The Divine Proportion. So the fact that the divine proportion and these various figures, the golden ratio, pops up so often in his art is no accident. I don't think it can possibly be an accident. I find it very interesting because there's a later chapter on chaos and fractal patterns, and you see the same phenomenon. Again, this is a mathematical pattern, a small repeating pattern of complexity building upon each other that creates this fractal image. Jackson Pollock used it in his paintings. It pops up in the sentence structure of Moby Dick and the Bible and certain poetry. And there is, in fact, a British composer who put together a program called Gingerbread, where you have a fractal image and you can click on the image and create music, your own sounds, your own music from fractal patterns.
Jennifer Ouellette joins us this hour. She's the author of Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, Tales from the Annals of Physics. You mentioned the religiosity of Leonardo's art in particular, and that brings me to something I wanted to ask you about the connection between, or the tension perhaps, between religion and science. You write about Galileo being forced to recant his belief in Copernicus, for example, and we've seen in our own time, of course, this ongoing tension sometimes between religion and science, most recently perhaps with the controversy over creationism or intelligent design. Mm-hmm. Can physics be politicized? Can physics be something that becomes part of this tension in contemporary times, between religion and science?
I think it can be if you're not careful. That tends to be the fault, I think, of the individuals more than the field itself. I do think that there is this divide. There's a lot of reasons for it. It need not be the case. I've been doing a lot of readings, and invariably I get someone coming up to me very defensive, and they say, well, Isaac Newton believed in God. And I say, well, yes, he did. And in fact, he wrote more about God than he wrote about physics. The difference here is that when Isaac Newton faced evidence that contradicted the church's interpretation of Scripture, he went with the evidence. He went with the science. He did not let his personal faith in God interfere with good science. And I think many people confuse faith with dogma, and that's, I think, the difference here. Church dogma, in the time of Copernicus in particular, dictated that the sun was not at the center, that the earth was at the center, and the sun and all the planets revolved around the earth. Well, all the scientific evidence contradicted that. So the dogma was based on a man-made interpretation. It was not a question of faith. It was a question of church doctrine. And I think we're seeing the same thing today in the intelligent design movement. People are unwilling to say that perhaps the way they're interpreting Scripture might be wrong, this insistence on a very literal interpretation. The flip side of that is that physicists can sometimes poo-poo the idea of personal faith. They can kind of trivialize it. And that has enabled certain parties to paint them with the brush of being atheists or all being antagonistic to religion. I think the only time that physicists get antagonistic to religion is when religion tries to cross over onto their turf and tries to tell them to alter their data or that their data can't be right. That's when I think you see that tension.
And what about crossing the other way? As you interviewed physicists, as you researched your book, did you come across people who struggled with this question or who came to a kind of accommodation between their faith and their scientific discipline?
I have met several of them like that. I've also met a fair number of agnostics and atheists. I can actually say that I had to come to that in my own life. I was raised by fundamentalist Christian parents. I would say that my parents are most likely creationists. We disagree on this. I'm not a creationist. But I had to come to grips with being comfortable with faith and science, where they diverge, and recognition of the fact that science describes the natural world through mathematical terms, physical laws. It really has nothing to say about the existence of God. I mean, that is inherently unprovable. And that's okay. I mean, its realm belongs in the empirical. It doesn't really belong in the realm of the metaphysical. And that there's room for both. I mean, the two can peacefully coexist if that's what you choose.
Jennifer Ouellette is the author of Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, Tales from the Annals of Physics. And we welcome your calls also this hour if you have questions about physics or faith, I guess, either one. You can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org, forum@kqed.org. I want to ask you, Jennifer Ouellette, about a couple of things in the book, starting with one that sort of creeps into your title, Black Bodies and Quantum Cats. And this is the famous mind question or mind problem of Schrödinger's cat. For those who aren't familiar with Schrödinger's cat, it's a bit like, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there, does it really make a sound? But it's slightly more grisly than that. So why don't you describe the problem as Schrödinger did? But then I want to ask you why it matters.
Okay. As Schrödinger described it, he pictured a cat placed in a box and you had a vial of cyanide. And there was like a little hammer that would be triggered next to a little bit of a uranium. And as the uranium decays, most of you know that certain radioactive elements decay and they emit radiation. That radiation would trigger the release, and the hammer would smash the vial, and the cyanide would poison the cat. The question becomes, if the box is closed, there's really only a 50-50% chance that that's going to break, that the uranium will decay to the point where it's triggered. So we really can't say, without opening the box and looking at it, whether the cat is alive or dead. What Schrödinger basically said was, well, if there's only a 50-50 chance and we can't actually determine whether it's alive or dead till we look, then clearly observation must determine reality. Where I think the confusion about Schrödinger's cat seems to pop up is that people misunderstand. They think this is describing reality at the macro world. Schrödinger's thought experiment was designed to illustrate the absurdity of the subatomic realm, where the rules change, where you get these ridiculous things that would never happen at the macro scale. And there's very good scientific reasons for that I won't go into. But essentially, that is exactly what happens at the subatomic scale, and it has to do with uncertainty. Uncertainty does not mean that we can't know for certain information about a particle. It means that we can't know two connected properties equally. If we know one connected property really, really precisely, then we can know next to nothing about, say, its position, if we know its speed or its velocity. The reason that this happens is because of how we have to look at the quantum realm, and it actually is what happens when you take Newtonian mechanics and bring it all the way down. Newtonian mechanics says inertia is based on mass, so the amount of force you need to move something depends on how heavy it is. Subatomic particles are very, very light. I think the top quark is 22 zeros after the decimal place, fractions of an ounce. That's how much it weighs. So if you shine, you know, a bit of light onto that, the light will affect it. The light will actually produce a force on the particle enough to change it. So the act of looking will change the state of the particle. Observation at the subatomic realm can determine reality. Mm-hmm. It does not happen at the macro scale because the masses are greater.
So this is the kind of thing that starts to make my head hurt. But
I know.
but the important part, it seems to me, is the last sentence, that this is a sort of thought game, thought exercise, to illustrate a particular point that observation at a certain level really does impact reality. Is that right? Heart of why it's important?
That is the heart of why it's important. At the subatomic scale, looking at something will change its nature.
And that also, I guess, when I also struggled, I will confess, reading the chapter about string theory at the end of the book. But part of why I struggled was not only because it may not represent my intellectual strengths, but also because I had a hard time understanding why it mattered. So, I mean, help us with that one too, because I think sometimes we sort of want to set physics aside, those of us who aren't scientifically oriented, not only because it's hard to understand, but it's hard to understand why it matters.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, that's a tough one. String theory, to put it bluntly, kicked my butt when I was trying to pick it up. I had to really like learn it and sit down with people and go over it over and over again to really understand what was being said there. It actually comes down to this problem of the fact that the laws of Newtonian physics break down at the subatomic realm. We basically have two sets of rules for describing the universe. That makes physicists very uncomfortable, and it's also not very efficient. The two sets of rules work fine, but there's certain things like the notion of a black hole or the birth of our own universe. The place where those things break down is called the singularity, that little infinite point. It's not a real point, it's a theoretical point, but we need something to describe that, because in order to do that, we can't talk about where we came from.
And so
it comes down to the Big Bang.
Yeah, and so the string theory is one of these so-called grand unifying theory that explain mm-hmm. those things that we otherwise can't understand. But my question is, so let's say I woke up tomorrow morning and there was a headline that said, you know, string theory proved true. How would it change my life? How would that make us any different?
Well, I'm not sure it would necessarily be immediate, because basic fundamental research doesn't always necessarily translate immediately into things we can touch and feel and taste and that change our lives. It can, however, open up entire new vistas, entire new ideas. If string theory is proven correct and there are extra dimensions, that's amazing. That means a lot of the science fiction that's out there could almost be true. Hmm. We could actually eventually harness enough energy to travel to other dimensions. We could maybe communicate through them through gravitational waves. String theory has a lot of radical, way-out ideas, and if it's proven to be true, that's a big deal, and it could conceivably, way down the line, completely revolutionize our notion of reality.
We have to take a break in just a moment, but that leads into something I did also want to ask you about, and maybe just a brief response, and then we'll pick it up after our break. But that part of our struggle with this topic probably is, too, is that it's not always immediately evident what the applicability of certain things are, certain discoveries are going to be. And as we began our hour talking about being open to ambiguity, would you also argue that part of what we have to be open to is not knowing where this will lead us, not knowing exactly what the applicability of a particular theory, where that may take us?
I think that's absolutely important, and I don't understand why people are uncomfortable with letting physics do that. I mean, art does not necessarily have an immediate applicability. Music doesn't. I mean, it's a part of our aesthetic impulse, and there is an aesthetic impulse, I think, to physics. And physicists certainly see it. What I hope to do, you know, through my writing and hopefully others will do so as well, is to communicate the beauty of it, that it is not this distant. It doesn't always have to be practical application. It can be beautiful just for the sake of beauty, for the way it enriches our lives.
Jennifer Ouellette, author of Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, Tales from the Annals of Physics. When we come back, we'll take your calls at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us your physics problems. You can do that at forum@kqed.org, forum@kqed.org. When we come back, we'll also have Jennifer Ouellette describe why deregulation of the power industry is not a good idea from a physics point of view. That discussion and more when we come back. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Jennifer Ouellette. Her book is called Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, Tales from the Annals of Physics. Jennifer, one of the parts of your book that I found the most intriguing is where you make the argument that deregulation of the power industry isn't necessarily good physics because, and I'm sure I'm way oversimplifying this, electricity doesn't do well with distance. Tell us about that a little bit more and whether or not it means that our lawmakers really need to pay attention to physics too.
Well, it's less that electricity doesn't do well over distance, and it's just how it travels. We figured out how to basically boost electricity at various points along the power line system, the power grid system, in order to, we send it over at very, very high voltages, and then we convert it down to lower voltages so that we can tap it in and use it in our homes. So we've figured out pretty well how to get it to travel over long distances. Where deregulation comes in, where the problem is just the way electricity behaves. I mean, it picks the path of least resistance. So basically, you need a very, very well-coordinated system. What happens with things like the big power blackouts in August 2001 that just wiped out the entire East Coast for a day, system overloaded. There wasn't enough communication. When they deregulized the power industry, companies became competitive with each other, and they began not sharing their data. I think one of the experts I talked to compared it to having all the musicians in the orchestra playing their own tune, each using different music, and then trying to coordinate everything. And it's just the result is a big old mess. It's not quite that bad with the power industry, but that's why blackouts are more likely to happen. And in fact, when they were debating deregulation, several experts pointed this out. Essentially, what happens is the lines get overloaded. You basically send electricity to where it's needed based on wherever it is. And it cannot be necessarily locally, but from all the way across the country. But when you do that, it's got to travel along all these highways. And if you hit one that happens to be having a lot of traffic, it's exactly what happens during Seattle during rush hour. You get a jam. Traffic stops. It comes to a standstill. The whole thing collapses. And then, of course, you get the shockwave that radiates out, and you can knock out other stations. And that's exactly what happened in August 2001. One overload tripped a breaker, and then it sort of sent a shockwave out and took out like four other stations, and you had this massive blackout all across the East Coast.
I said somewhat facetiously before, does it mean that lawmakers ought to take physics? But I guess I really do want to ask that question in a sense, because just as we talked in the first part of our program about the continuity between physics and art and culture, I wonder how that might apply to public policy decision-making as well, and whether or not in that same way, we need to have our public policymakers a richer understanding of science.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things I find very heartening is that there are, in fact, in the House of Representatives, two elected physicists. Rush Holt is a Democrat from New Jersey, and Vern Ehlers is a Republican, I believe, from Michigan. I'm not sure about that.
Do they work together?
I think they do. They work together on a lot of bipartisan issues of science and technology. President Bush's new innovation agenda, I think, you're going to see a lot of bipartisan interlocking. It's the first time I've seen the Bush administration really pay attention to science and technology, so I'm very interested to see how that plays out. It is, of course, a very vital thing. There are many science lobbyists, scientists who become lobbyists in Washington. They don't necessarily get heard, and I'm hoping that because physics holds the answer to some real-world problems, that their voices will start to be heard a bit more in Washington.
Jennifer Willett joins us. She's the author of Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, Tales from the Annals of Physics. And to your calls, first to Brian in Richmond. Go ahead, Brian. Or rather, I'm sorry, I guess this is David in Berkeley. David, go ahead.
Yes, she sort of made a comment implying that, you know, physicists aren't antagonistic towards religion. Well, you know, I have a degree in conceptual physics, one of the few people who does, and I'm certainly antagonistic against religion, and there are plenty of other physicists who are, except they can't speak out because they would lose their grants, et cetera, et cetera. Fortunately for me, I'm economically independent, and I don't have to rely on doing research for the government. So I don't appreciate her making comments like that, especially since she's not a physicist.
So you choose to be antagonistic.
Oh, I'm more. Yes.
Okay. All right, David. Thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Jennifer Willett.
Yeah, I do have a comment for that. I think that that just makes the ongoing debate that much more difficult. I'm not necessarily religious. Most of my friends are, in fact, atheist or agnostic. They do not necessarily have faith. My family, however, does have faith. Some of my friends do. I think that this just clouds the debate. The people we're antagonistic towards are the people who are trying to tell us how to act and how to behave, and I think that's perfectly viable. But I don't necessarily think that that kind of antagonism is inherent. I think that it does not mean that science and faith can't coexist.
It's interesting because we live in such a polarized time, and you look at the legislature here in California, for example, which has a difficult time, and there are two sort of lonely souls, one Democrat and one Republican, who try to work together. But what you're suggesting is that that sort of polarization extends and is a way hurtful to the very pursuit of knowledge that you're encouraging us to have. And to the next of our calls, Roger, go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you. I personally find mathematics and physics to be great clarifiers of thought. My favorite philosopher and one of my four heroes was Bertrand Russell. He made his breakthrough principally by using mathematics to advance his philosophy. So I think people have a lot to gain, particularly young students have a lot to gain, by pursuing mathematics. And particularly in engineering, this country is desperate, has a desperate need for that kind of education and that kind of student. And we're falling way behind the other countries like India and China.
Yeah, Roger, thanks very much for the observation. Jennifer Ouellette, takes us back to the observation you were just making about encouraging technology in the classroom and the latest initiative of the administration. And I wanted to ask you about women in particular in this. You write in your book about that the number of physics majors has tripled in the last 30 years or so. So that's an encouraging sign. But what more do you think needs to be done in that way to encourage more women to take up and continue with the hard sciences, not only through college, but into graduate work as well? Jennifer Ouellette, are you there? We've apparently lost our guest, so we'll continue and take a couple of more calls and hope to get our guest, Jennifer Ouellette, back on the air with us in just a moment. She is the author of Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, Tales from the Annals of Physics, and we'll get her back on the line as soon as we can. In the meantime, let's get another observation from one of our callers this morning. Bill in Castro Valley, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment about her interest in scientific inquiry in the classroom. Hello?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, yes, I'm here. Right. At any rate, I've worked a lot in trying to get engineering design in the classroom, and I've often found that the classroom is about success, getting the right answer, and what I try to encourage is to recognize failure has a learning and role also, particularly when it comes to design and inquiry. So I just wanted her comments about whether she's found that true and getting that into the classroom, the role of failure and how it plays in the learning process.
And we'll try to get those comments from her as soon as we get her back on the air. Jennifer, are you back with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, sorry, we lost you for a moment. Were you able to hear the question from Bill in Castro Valley?
No, not at all.
Okay, what he was asking was the way in which you could encourage more scientific interest in the classroom. And before that, I was asking about encouraging more girls and young women in particular to take up the sciences. And he was talking about that it's important to acknowledge failure instead of just always focusing on success, and that kids need to have a sense of the role that failure can actually play in the advancement and the gaining of further knowledge.
That is an excellent point, and it's one I agree with wholeheartedly. I myself learned through failure. In fact, I remember talking to a physicist who said that one of the reasons he chose to study the field was when he was a freshman in college, he started taking the Saturday morning seminar taught by a grad student. And every Saturday morning, the grad student would come into the class, he would write an equation or a problem on the board, and for the next hour, he would fail to solve it. And what it got across to the students was that it wasn't about always having the right answer. It wasn't always about scoring high on the test. It was basically about discovery. And part of discovery is sometimes you're wrong. Part of learning is that you make the mistakes and you learn from them, and you just pick yourself up and you persevere and you keep at it. That, to me, makes physics a very heroic, noble endeavor.
And what about encouraging more women to take up that noble endeavor? You wrote in your book about how there are now three times as many physics majors among women as there were 30 years ago. Is there something more that could be done that will encourage more people to take up that calling?
I think that now that there is an awareness of the problem, I think that a lot is being done to address it. Obviously, more needs to be done. But when I first started as a science writer, I would go to physics conferences and I would frequently be the only woman in the room, and there was never a line for the ladies' room, which was wonderful. But that was the downside. I've been doing it for about 12 years now, and now I go to the physics conferences, and there's always another woman, sometimes more. So I can definitely see that we're reaching a critical mass. And I say we because as a science writer, that's another field. There are not a lot of women who write about physics, whether they're physicists or writers or whatever. So I do experience a very similar thing.
Lots of emails coming in, and including a number, and this won't surprise you, Jennifer, about the golden ratio. Be careful what you say about the golden ratio. Much of the aesthetic claims regarding the ratio are folklore, not fact. And another person writes it, that the Da Vinci Code gets it all terribly wrong. But it's more distressing that a book on physics for a popular audience might continue that mythology. So why don't you clarify, if you can, because I think some of our listeners are getting a certain impression about whether what you endorse about the role of the golden ratio, not only in the Da Vinci Code, but its role in art as well.
Well, I think I actually did say it, and I'm very careful to make the point in the book, is that artistic intent is extremely difficult to prove, and that a lot of it is, in fact, coincidence. There are several theories out by, you know, perceptual psychologists and physicists like Bulent Adelet, who is both an artist and a scientist, who believe that human beings have a natural affinity for the divine proportion. But I think several of your people are correct. The Da Vinci Code does get a few of the items wrong. It tends to assume that there's some sort of magic sort of thing going on, conspiracy and that sort of thing for why the divine proportion keeps popping up. And it's not necessarily true. The Parthenon, for example, is not necessarily in divine proportion. I mean, it's not exactly 1.618. And for an artist or something, that might not seem significant, but that one difference is very significant to a physicist. So, yes, I say they're raising a very valid point, and the book does not necessarily portray the divine proportion as being necessarily deliberately done in all of art.
And some emails coming in from Paul, this one about quantum mechanics. My physics major roommate told me that if you are standing on one side of an impenetrable wall and a hungry lion is standing on the other side, quantum mechanics allows you to calculate when you'll be eaten. Is that a good definition?
It has to do with quantum tunneling. And again, it's a phenomenon where you can't necessarily determine the location of a particle. So if his friend was the size of a subatomic particle, it would be much easier for him to just sort of magically appear on the other side and have a subatomic lion eat him. At the macro scale, the good news is probabilities being what they are, the numbers get so large, every single one of your atoms would have to be, you know, lined up exactly right just so in order for that probability to become a reality. And it would take roughly the life of the time of the entire universe, at which point you'd be dead. So there's really either you're going to wait the lifetime of the entire universe and you'll be dead long before the lion eats you. I just don't think it's relevant. But it's another Schrodinger's cat kind of joke.
Yeah.
And it's a nice way to illustrate quantum tunneling.
And now to Wanda in San Francisco. Wanda, go ahead.
Hi. Well, first I'd like to respond to that physicist who thinks he can speak for every physicist. I don't think he can anymore speak for every physicist than she can speak, and I don't think she was trying to speak for every physicist. And secondly, he perpetuates the model of the stuffy physicist who probably, in reality, never thought of anything very new. He doesn't sound very open-minded. But having gone on with that, I would just like to say that as far as the golden rectangle and the Fibonacci numbers, they are repeated, in fact, in nature constantly in the Nautilus and the flowers, the center of the sunflowers, etc. And, her mention of the Da Vinci Code, it seems to have ired some stuffy types who feel like that's a no-no. But, you know, those stuffy types have to realize that they don't own science, and it's a good thing they don't, because if they did, we'd never get anywhere, and the young minds trying to open, I teach, and you have to use art, you have to use a lot of things to open their minds, because if they just look at a series of Fibonacci numbers, if they're not really in love with numbers, those numbers don't mean anything, and they don't inspire you, but if they look at a Nautilus shell, if they see the rationale behind it, then they can catch on and they can go, it means something. It isn't just something that's a math equation. It actually has a reality and it's visually real to me.
Wanda, thank you. Thanks for the call and for the observation. Jennifer Ouellette, on that point, we haven't really talked about that much, but you can see some of the things that are described as laws of physics that do, in fact, play out in nature, as Wanda was describing. Give us an example or two of that.
She mentioned the Nautilus shell, which definitely has
describe that
the
for
golden
us.
Ratio in it. Well, the Nautilus shell, I mean, we've all seen it. It's basically it's a spiral. It's an algorithmic spiral. All these various little chambers, and all of those things are basically in divine proportion. If you like, if you divide the ratio, if you figure out the ratios for them, they are basically 1.618 roughly in that area. You see it. Ironically, in the way the falcon flies, if you've ever seen a falcon hunt, it does these very swooping paths as it's narrowing down down to its prey. And if you track the trajectory of that path and crunch the numbers to figure out the ratio, they are, in fact, it follows the golden ratio. It follows a divine proportion. So there is a certain extent to which math translates to reality in an aesthetic sense, not just in the Newtonian sense of the fact that it determines the strength of gravity.
And next to Murali in Fremont. Hope I've pronounced that right. Go ahead, please.
I wanted to comment on the immediate applicability of science.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Pure science and especially physics, if we exclude math, often, comes up with theories that do not have immediate applicability, but it turns out that later on they have wide industrial use and so on. And one such theory was electromagnetism. And in fact, there is a very nice anecdote about Faraday. He was asked, what is the applicability of electromagnetism and why, he was working on this theory which does not have any immediate use. And his response was, what is the use of a newborn baby? A newborn baby has no immediate use, but you nurture the baby, you put all your thoughts and energy into it, and it turns out to be someone who contributes something to society later on.
Yeah, nice story. Thanks very much for calling that in. Yeah, appreciate
okay.
it.
Yeah.
It is one of the stories that I also appreciated in your book, which did have immediate applicability, was the story of the X-ray, because the inventor of the X-ray, Wilhelm Röntgen, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, was also incredibly altruistic. He didn't take out a patent, right, because he wanted to make sure that that invention had not only immediate applicability, but widespread and could be used by anyone.
X-rays was a very unusual incident in the history of physics because, the caller is right. Normally, there's often a very long lead time between the discovery of something very, very fundamental and figuring out how to harness that for a practical application. X-rays, it was almost immediate. I mean, they were desperate for a way to figure out, to be able to image the skeleton, the human body. And this guy discovered them purely by accident. I actually love Röntgen because he did that, because he did not take a patent on it. And he died impoverished as a result. And he's not the only one. Nikola Tesla did the same thing. He had an agreement with George Westinghouse for his AC power. But if he collected all the royalties owed to him under that agreement as AC power became more dominant, he would have bankrupted the company. He would have destroyed his own invention. So he ripped up the agreement, and he basically sold the rights to his technology to Westinghouse for a set fee, and Tesla also died impoverished. So I think that we owe these heroes a great debt of thanks, that they did not let their personal greed, their personal sense of comfort get in the way of letting us all benefit from their inventions.
And it's important to know, for those who are interested in reading the book, that it really, the subtitle of your book, Tales from the Annals of Physics, they really are stories, and they really are mm-hmm. stories populated by real and fascinating characters as well. Couple more emails coming in. As an electrical engineer, I find that our educational system is too narrow. The art of engineering has been deleted. Intuition as applied to engineering is actually frowned upon, but most of the great scientists of the Renaissance were artists as well. Another one, thanks for this program and your book. I've always loved physics, math, and nature. It's always seemed intuitively obvious to me that there is harmony throughout music, numbers, physical bodies, celestial bodies, atoms and some atomic particles. So it seems like a lot of people, Jennifer Ouellette, are responding to that part of your argument, which takes you back, and I want to ask you again about this, about what you hope really will come out of this, what you want people to get a sense of in terms of all of these kinds of interconnections that we're describing.
Well, just that. I mean, I want them to get a sense of the interconnections. I think we've become very, very over-specialized. Physics also has become very over-specialized, where even within physics disciplines, they sometimes have trouble talking to each other. I think that the divide that we're seeing between science and faith and the ongoing intelligent design debate is a direct result of science education making science physics seem rather scary and separate, so that we get this huge gap between the people who are scientifically literate and the people who just for some reason never got it. What I hope my book does, because it tells stories, because it lets you see them as people, that is how I came through physics, to the back door. They won me back because I got to know the people. And I learned through them how to make those vital connections. And for me, context is everything, and I think that's true of a lot of other people. What I want to do is reach the people who were like me, the people who resist, the people who are afraid of it, who think we're not smart enough, who think that we just don't think the right way. The emailer who wrote that intuition is frowned upon. Well, for some reason, to a certain extent, you have to kind of be careful with that. On the other hand, you have to leave room for creativity. The fact that creativity is missing from our science education is a mistake, I think, because creativity is what speaks to the young minds.
And I think that's what our next caller wants to talk about as well. Shubhad in Foster City. Go ahead, please.
Our science education.
Hello?
Young minds.
And I think that's what our next caller.
We're having a hard time picking you up, Shubhad. You may need to turn down your radio, and then can you try that, please, and then ask your question?
Hello?
Hello. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. It's a great conversation. I'm a physics graduate, and I would like to comment on that one, that the courses sometimes are very dry, and the professors are very strict. So some people left the courses in the middle of the semester, and that's a very discouragement for all the people. So I would like to comment that the courses should be more interesting and the professor should be more friendly to progress in the research of the field and of physics.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
Thanks.
And we should acknowledge, Jennifer Ouellette, that while your book in part is aimed at people like me who don't come to physics very easily, it's not like it's only for people like that. I mean, it seems to me that just as Shubhad was saying, in his physics class or people who are professionals within that field could gain something by sort of injecting this field with a degree of passion and life. Is that part of what you also hope can happen?
Yes, and I've actually gotten some very good feedback from physicists who've read the book and very much enjoyed finding little nuggets of information that even they didn't know about their own history. They like reading the stories. I realize that physics education is poorly taught and there are some very bad teachers out there, but if you talk to physicists socially, they actually come alive. And I wish that they would bring more of that into the classroom with them because they are vibrant, alive people, and they are solving real problems, and they do learn through failure. And I don't know why that doesn't translate into the classroom. For some reason, their personality changes the minute they walk through that classroom door.
Mm. One thing we haven't talked about yet, and we just have a few moments remaining, but that's the consequence sometimes of decisions. And I'm thinking particularly, of course, about the atomic bomb, and you write about Oppenheimer. To what extent does that play out in this drama about that? And are people, in the end, responsible for the consequence of their own creations, their own intuitions, their own discoveries?
Well, I'm a big believer in personal responsibility, and I think that Oppenheimer and others were also. Oppenheimer was devastated by what they had wrought. That does not mean that they were wrong to pursue knowledge. It just means that knowledge in and of itself is not good or evil. It depends on how it's used, on how it's harnessed. And I think that that's where physics kind of rubs up against ethics and morality and the kinds of people. We want to instill, you know, a certain sense of how will our actions affect the rest of the world. And just because we can do something, does that mean we should? It's one thing to understand nuclear power. It's quite another to build something that is capable of wiping out entire cities. I mean, it's an awesome, amazing accomplishment to have made the atomic bomb, but it had a huge human cost, even though it stopped a horrific war. And I think that's a very muddy gray area. But physics obviously has a social component, and we have to take that seriously and address it. That same topic is coming up, obviously, with nanotechnology. And I can see, actually, in Washington and among, in the scientific community, they are making efforts to already start addressing the social implications of nanotech, so they can stop this from, you know, stop the repercussions, or at least understand the consequences before it becomes widespread.
Jennifer Ouellette is the author of Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, Tales from the Annals of Physics. We just have a moment left, so I want to ask you what you're going to write about next.
I am writing a book called The Physics of the Buffyverse, based on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel, and just handed in the revised manuscript. It's basically where black bodies kind of flirted with pop culture. I just embraced it in the Buffyverse. It's a lot of fun, and I hope people like it.
And give us one quick example of where you're taking that story.
Well, I do things like talk about electromagnetism. I talk about the thermodynamics of magic from a metaphorical aspect, exactly how much energy it would take to turn Mayor Wilkins in Season 3 into a giant snake demon, everything down to what's the best wood to stake a vampire with, and that would be ash.
And when will this book be out?
It will be out probably about a year from now, January 2007.
Jennifer Ouellette, author of Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, Tales from the Annals of Physics. Thanks very much for being on our program this morning.
Thank you.
Really a pleasure to have you. Forum is produced by Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez, and the engineer this past hour has been Danny Bringer. Coming up next week on Forum, our topics will include the ongoing police controversy in San Francisco. There's been a recent series in the San Francisco Chronicle about the use of force in the San Francisco Police Department, and a proposal from Mayor Gavin Newsom about increasing the number of policemen in the city of San Francisco to try to clear more of the homicide cases within that city. That will be our topic Monday morning at 9 o'clock on Forum. And then in the second hour, for those of you who want to get ready for Valentine's Day, the subject of intimacy, sexuality, and love will be the pre-Valentine's Day topic in the second hour. That's Monday morning on Forum with Michael Krasny. Thanks very much for joining us this hour. Hope you all have a pleasant weekend. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.